with Coach Ogeron, former head coach of the Madison Utah Tigers and Ole Miss Rebels and USC Trojans, and you know, defensive line coach over there at the U, and I did some work with the Saints and everything else. And you know, I'm Coach O, bitch. You listen out there, anchor with the podcast on the Danny Belts and all that. And I want to say right now, you know, this week we're going to be talking about the burden of leadership. You know, Coach O, been a different type of leader, different places. You know, I was over there at the U. I had The Rock. I had Warren Sapp, you know, position coach. I got that interim coach job over there at USC after I was coordinator. And, you know, when I go to Ole Miss, I challenged my team to a fight. You know, that was my leadership style. I was like, I'm Coach O, bitch. Let's go, boy. You know, nobody wanted to fight me. And you know, I had to do so well there. But by the time I go to LSU, I'm more like a CEO in my leadership burden. You know, I have a coordinator, and I hire, I fire, I rehire, I re-promote. And, you know, then they go off, and then I try to get new ones, and they don't work out. And, well, anyway, I ain't got a job no more, you know, but I got that $16 million, baby. That's my leadership right there, because I am Coach O, bitch. Go Tigers.
Cycles, we'll lose part of the system for a while. You know, there's a finite amount of memory. You can't use it for everything. We're going to compile for half an hour.
Go ahead. All of you. I'm approaching the Tyrannosaur paddock.
This is a message for liberal white women. Look, nobody's coming for your abortions, okay? What we really want is common sense abortion control. That means mandatory background checks with mental health assessments, along with entering a national registry for abortions and paying a $200 tax stamp that could take up to 1 year on a wait list to receive.
Welcome to the Sports Antidote, episode number 104. I'm your host, Danny Belts, but I know it when I see it. But I know it when I see it.
Sing it, Kenny!
I just saw Top Gun. Wow. I'll just save that with Tommy Bench. He's going to be joining the show today. Bro Exotic is out. Top Gun, 9.5 out of 10. And I'm being very conservative at that. Today's episode, very straightforward. We're going to talk about a very famous quote by somebody from the Supreme Court some time ago in a very controversial case in comparison to "But I Know It When I See It." And I have several examples to back that up in sports, one particularly in politics. I want to talk about ads on YouTube. Honestly, I think we're all on the same page here. A certain baseball player, some quarterbacks, some progress, one baseball player in particular, and then another one. Oh, but on two separate sides of the scale. It's going to be a very well-rounded episode. Looking forward to this one here. I'm in lovely Alabama, and it is hot. It's hot as hell outside. So in an attempt not to be like a corny stand-up comedian, oh, what's the deal with these airplanes? Okay, yeah, what's the deal with these YouTube ads? And here's the thing. They are beyond annoying, and the fact that they allow you to skip this in 5, 4, 3, I can't press it fast enough. And it actually has the reverse effect. I'm never going to buy the stupid shit that you are holding me up from the music that I want to hear, the interview that I want to hear. I don't care what it is. Matter of fact, if it is anything that I'm currently buying, I will stop buying. And these ads are ridiculous. And the thing is they're so frequent and so stupid and repetitive, it really does make you hate. It's actually the reverse effect for advertisement. And I know I'm wrong on this because obviously I'm not a marketer, but I refuse to believe for someone like me, a normal guy. Oh, well, that's a statement. So kind of a normal guy. Most of our audience here does not appreciate these ads as well. So I actually sent an email to YouTube's customer center. Customer service, worded it very strategically, used a couple big words in there. They'll probably have to pull up Webster for at least one of them. And I'm going to read to you their response. Now, in lieu of me just reading you the email I sent them, just take my word for it. It was hilarious. So we'll be hopefully getting a response from, you know, big tech and see where that goes. I can't wait. And I'm sure with bated breath on the edge of your seat, you can't wait as well. Be sure and rate, subscribe, and review, or Bro Exotic will cuck you. Reach out, touch a brother, tell somebody about the Sports Antidote today. Follow us on Instagram, at the sports antidote. And speaking of Instagram, when we post something on the story, we'll get basically like 500 to 600 people that will see it because we have like 1,300 followers. We used to have like 1,500. When we post something on Instagram, we'll get like 3 likes. No one even sees it. Instagram is a joke. As much as I like it personally, once you get pissed on by the dog, the urine scent will never leave you. There's no washing it off with ammonia. There's no taking a bath in cranberry juice. You get skunked, or ketchup, whatever the hell, tomato juice, you get skunked, and it will stay on you forever. So be sure and follow us on Instagram as we stick it to the man. That's right. One episode at a time, brick by brick by brick. So let's lead this off, but I know it when I see it. We'll get into the thick of that. We're going to go mid-reverse here, so we'll kind of circle back, unlike the press secretary, Jen Psaki, previous press secretary. Oh, this Jean-Pierre is just great, isn't she? I mean, she's what that. How do you downgrade from Jen Psaki? I actually feel bad for her, and they continue to take it easy on her. Here's Peter Ducey right here. At least he still pulls no punches. But it is just, let's just move it on. But I know it when I see it. So there was a guy that jumped on the Arizona Diamondbacks club some time ago. A first baseman, his name's Paul Goldschmidt. Arizona, of one of the smallest markets in Major League Baseball. I watched him mash the ball around every ballpark in this country for years. In the MVP candidacy a couple times, but never really, I guess, had the cachet or whatever you want to call it for the large market Major League Baseball teams in order for him to be in consideration to be the best player in whatever league he's in. He's always been in the National League and continues to be now with the St. Louis Cardinals, which we'll get to in 1 second. And Goldschmidt also is the best fielding first baseman just about every year. First base glove doesn't really get many props until you start digging 2 hoppers out the dirt, getting off the bag and tagging people. He's very limber. He's 50 times better than Freddie Freeman ever was, to be honest with you. He is. And sprays the ball everywhere. He's not the big dumb lefty you can shift on. He will smash that ball to left field. He is nearly unpitchable, protected by Arenado in that lineup. I was close to hitting the MVP, missed it by 1 spot in the Cardinals lineup. It will not be Arenado, who's having a phenomenal year, by the way. But Goldschmidt is doing some things that are just otherworldly, and we're going to talk about that right now. But when I first saw him playing a while ago, it was his rookie season, and he went 5 for 5 with 7 RBI. He had a home run, he had a triple, and 2 doubles, 4 for 4 with a walk, excuse me. He was a single shy of the cycle. And the ball was flying all over the park. And he was doing this versus Clayton Kershaw, not exactly a bum, one of the best pitchers of my generation, one of the best pitchers of all times, full stop, period. And, you know, Trevor Story kind of did this when he came to the Rockies. He hit like 7 home runs in his first like 8 games and all this. And then people caught up to him. He plays for the Red Sox now. He bats like 200, but he's on pace to knock in like 120 RBI. So, you know, you'll take that if you're the Red Sox. But Goldschmidt has always done this in a different way. Instead of being the power-hitting big dumb lefty, like let's say like an Adam Dunn or a Chris Johnson, this guy bats for average power, just about everything. And when you put it all together with the correct lineup, now you have a guy that virtually is unpitchable. You cannot pitch to him. If you do, I mean, you're going to pay the price. Just ask the Milwaukee Brewers. I think he's batting about 900 versus them this year. But I know it when I see it. Early on, I knew it. I was like, is anybody seeing this? This guy is mashing everyone. And it kind of under the radar. Small market teams with good players on small market teams will always go under the radar in Major League Baseball. But I am not surprised that he's in the spot that he is now. I thought it would be Arenado, but it indeed is Paul Goldschmidt. And you can't really walk the guy too much because then you have to see Nolan. And it's not a good situation. And then they have Edmund, who is the top WAR player in WAR, wins against replacement. Edmund's number 1. No one even knows that. And Goldschmidt is number 2 in all of Major League Baseball. Arenado is 15. They have top 3 people with the WAR, which is a very important statistic for offensive and defensive production, to make that statistic wins against replacement. Not to bore you with a bunch of stats, but to have the one and the two guy is virtually unheard of. It never happens, and it hasn't happened since the statistic was made about 9 years ago. Goldschmidt right now is second in Major League Baseball in batting average, first in the National League. He's batting .349 as a power-hitting, true third to fourth hitter. If he's fourth, Arnado's fifth. If he's batting third, Arnado's cleanup. 16 home runs, that's seventh in Major League Baseball, third in the National League. 56 RBIs, that's third in Major League Baseball, second in the National League. His OBP is second in Major League Baseball, first in the National League. He's been walked the seventh most times in Major League Baseball, fifth in the National League. His slugging percentage at .640, it's outrageous. Third in Major League Baseball, first in the National League. His WAR, second in Major League Baseball, second in the National League, only behind Edman. And his OPS is number one in both. Okay, so that right there has never happened. Not even Bryce Harper or Mike Trout in their heyday, and they're still in their heyday, were able to garner everything top 10, the lowest top 7, and lead your respective league in just about everything. Oh, and he's one of the hardest strikeouts in Major League Baseball. So when you add all that in, you have this guy that I knew it when I saw it. I didn't think it would happen to this extent this quickly with this team, but it has. He's going to win the Silver Slugger. Right now, he's the undisputed unanimous MVP of the National League. Full stop. I don't want to hear this Manny Machado bullshit. Sorry. Also, the Padres, I mean, I guess they're winning now, but the Cardinals are threatening to win. I mean, it's early. It's mid-June, but they are taking full advantage of the Brewers' skid. The Brewers. He's probably going to win or not get close to winning the Triple Crown. I mean, this guy's going to win every single award. It'll be like Daniel Day-Lewis in some movie. He's going to sweep. And it is just insane. And I am not surprised. A long time ago, when I saw this, I somehow, not that, oh, I have some special ability. No, but when I see talent early on, I'm like, man, is anybody seeing this? The same could be said with Bailey Zappe. Not to hit you over the head with this, we won't. But when I saw him playing for Houston Baptist, he was doing some things that simply were incredible. It's not a stat-stuffing gimmick offense where, you know, the Graham Harrells of Texas Tech under Mike Leach, where you can hit Crabtree for a two-yard slant and he runs for 80 yards. Not really the case, as this guy was throwing 40-yard deep posts, you know, over the cornerback, underneath the safety, right between the linebackers, making these throws in impossible windows. I don't care if you do that at a JUCO, like my boy Sides did in Arizona. I think they were called the Artichokes or something. In the JUCO level, if you're making these throws, any quarterback will tell you, and so will he, you make these throws on Sunday. I mean, you either can or you can't, and he can, and soon he will be making them on Sunday. And if Mac Jones goes down, you're probably going to see Bailey Zappe step in under Bill Belichick, taking direct snaps for the New England Patriots. Pretty impressive, considering just 2 years ago he was playing for Houston Baptist University. The same goes with Cam Ward. Not going to pound you over the head with this, but we are going to circle back to Cam Ward, but in a different light. Cam Ward does things that are otherworldly, even to the a more extended version of Zappe, as Ward is built like an absolute freight train, is faster than most of your linebackers, probably some of your slower defensive backs. And I knew it when I saw him at Incarnate Word early on, making some of these plays. It was not because of the athleticism being inferior to his. FCS is fine at the skill positions. They're fine. But he was making some throws, as herky and jerky as his release is, and he's a lefty and all of this. He's still, I could see it, and I'm not surprised that he's at Washington State, even though a guy like Lane Kiffin wanted him at Ole Miss. It was a package deal. They couldn't go with that, as you all know. And we've been keeping you abreast of the Cam Ward saga. Cannot wait for them to play Idaho week one and then Wisconsin week two. By the way, that line opened up at 17.5. I'm not the only one looking at this. Now it's at 11.5 for the future wager on week two versus Wisconsin. We'll get to that water when we see the bridge. A better example of I know it when I see it is Russell Wilson. So I remember in 2008, this freshman for North Carolina State, Russell Wilson, was playing Wake Forest, and I'm watching him do things that I really just don't see. He moves like Mike Vick. He's not as fast as Mike Vick, but he kind of moves like him. and he throws the ball farther than Uncle Rico over them there mountains, quarter mile. So here you got a guy with a cannonball launcher over here. You got a guy that's wildly elusive, in phenomenal shape. He's a very difficult sack, and can extend the play while also executing everything you'd want a quarterback to be able to do. He can do all of these things. And in 2008 for North Carolina State, he played 11 games, a standard college football season. He started basically every game. They didn't go to a bowl game, whatever. And then the next year at North Carolina State, he's a sophomore. I don't believe he was a true sophomore, but it was his sophomore season. 2009, they played 12 games, so one more game than last year, and his statistics were better than the year before when he played 11 games. Then, in 2010, he played 13 games, one game more than the previous year of 12, and his statistics grew as well. And then when he transferred to Wisconsin in 2011, I was surprised that no one really was talking about this. That's when I met the Parlay King in Houston, who is a Wisconsin fan. He's from that area, Milwaukee. And we both agreed this guy is, we're going to be riding this gravy train. Well, Wisconsin against the spread that year was ridiculous, because now you finally have a quarterback for Wisconsin who's not some bum-ass white boy who can't really do anything but hand the ball off to Monty Ball or whatever running back du jour Wisconsin's going to send in the first round, as they usually do. Russell Wilson was doing things that I can't believe people weren't picking up on, and the fact that they said it wouldn't translate to the NFL really made me scratch my head. Again, I went to culinary school. I'm not an expert, but how did everyone not notice this guy was going to be as good as he is? Did I think he'd be as good as he was in pros? No, but I thought he'd be a really good pro. I didn't think he'd be an MVP candidate nearly every year, depending on how well his team does, in this case the Seahawks, now Denver. But in 2011, they played 14 games, so one more than the previous year of 13. They beat Sparty in the Big Ten Championship as he threw for 3 touchdowns, completed about every pass. And then they lost in that crazy game to Oregon in the Rose Bowl. This is the same year that LSU just annihilated Oregon week 1 in Dallas and in Jerry World. I was at a wedding in Washington watching this go down, Washington State. And you can clearly see that, he, 11, 12, 13, then 14 games. They didn't win that game, but he had a really good showing. 300 yards, 2 touchdowns, ran for 1. Interception, return, wasn't even his fault. Went through somebody's hands and was taken to the house. But with the progression one sees here, I knew it when I saw it in 2008. How does a guy like this go in the third round? How is he the 74th pick of the NFL draft? And people still scratching their heads. Even Pete Carroll wondering, how did we walk into this guy? Well, it's because the offensive coordinator was the one that coached against him in the Big Ten and knew, like, we need to get this kid. It's a steal. And, of course, Pete Carroll didn't want him, and he wanted Matt Flynn, who had just put on that crazy game for Green Bay, week 17, threw for, like, 18 touchdowns and got paid. Matt Flynn, they should do a 30-for-30 on him, and he's a hilarious follow on Twitter, by the way. But it shouldn't be a surprise to everyone, because if I knew it when I saw it, How do the professionals not? I just don't grasp the reality of how am I so far ahead of you on these certain things? Zappy, way ahead of the world. We know that. Check. No one knew who he was. He breaks every record. Ward, how am I so far ahead? Just because I saw them? I'm not the only person that has internet and a television. So when I see something early on, especially to this caliber, it typically comes to pass, whether it's Goldschmidt, Zappy, soon to be Ward, or Russell Wilson. But it also goes the other way. Yasiel Puig, one of the most interesting players to ever hit the professional sports scene. First off, Puig's appearance, something otherworldly. He stands at flat-footed 6'3", 240 pounds. 240 pounds. His legs the size of tree trunks, his upper body something out of a magazine. This guy, they had to get special jerseys for him because his biceps were like the size of, they were bigger than Barry Bond. Like, this guy's arms were just extensions of his legs, except the upper appendage. And he was a monster when he first came to Major League Baseball, and he got into a big market team, unlike Goldschmidt. And Puig, in 2013, was an all-star, batted 319, and made some unbelievable plays in center field. Puig, usually with a cannon of an arm like this, let me just segue here or just branch off. Yasiel Puig is the most naturally gifted baseball player, in my opinion, in the history of Major League Baseball. Now, I know right there, Mad Dog Russo would fire up. Wow, sure, Yasiel Puig's good. Sure, he's fine. He's good. He's no Whitey Ford. I wouldn't say he's no Ted Williams. But sure, he's good. He's fine. Sure. But, you know, he's no Hank Aaron. But I think that with the ability that he had, speed, cannon, 5-tool player, we haven't seen anything really like this. And they, instead of putting me at right field, where you have the strongest arm typically on your team for outfielders, because the throw to right field to third base is the longest, and that plays a lot. Runner on first, and someone tries to stretch that single hit to right field to third, you want that guy out. Big difference between first and third, no out, as in one out, runner on third. So you want to have that cannon. But he's so fast and covers so much ground, you want him in center field. It's a good problem to have if you're a manager. It's a quandary we rarely see. Normally you don't have, like, Mike Trout's very gifted in the outfield, but he's in left field because he doesn't have that good of an arm. But Puig had an absolute cannonball. So you have all these things with Yasiel Puig, but on the other end, I did not see what everyone else saw, and I would prove to be right again. I was the only person that brought this up to anyone that I know of, saying that he has the same statistics as Jeff Francoeur. Who's Jeff Francoeur? Go back and look. He came in right around the time Jason Heyward came before that to the Atlanta Braves. They played the same position, except Francoeur was in right field, sometimes first base. But they both hit the ball nearly the same statistically, both physically intimidating people. However, Francoeur would initially drop off year by year, much like Yasiel Puig did. Not surprised Francoeur did. People just find a way to get you out. Okay, baseball always finds a way with most people. And with Puig, it wasn't so much breaking balls, wasn't so much anything. I saw this, but I know it when I see it. I knew this when I saw it. Just throw anything not in the zone that's in the zone initially. In other words, a slider or a cutter. Anything in the zone that would leave the zone right before contact to the catcher, Puig chases everything. He chases everything. When pitchers realized this, they slidered him out of Major League Baseball. Fact. And the thing is, how am I able to see the arguments I would get in with people about this guy, comparing him, they're already like, oh, he's going to be in the Hall of Fame. Oh, he's going to, well, no, not really. Because, you know, 3 years later, after all of these charades, by the way, his antics in the outfield, constantly trying to turn something into nothing, always trying to stretch singles into doubles, getting thrown out, making these ridiculous bonehead plays, just had no ethic at all. The tools, we've never seen a baseball player with this caliber. Physical strength, fastest guy on the team, strongest guy on the team, biggest guy on the team, all these things. Strongest arm on the team, all you name it. But with Puig, I noticed early this was not going to sustain, and he was slaughtered right out of Major League Baseball. 2014, his average drops 20 points to 296, 25 points. And the next year, 2015, he's batting 255, and now he's not even an everyday starter. This happened very quickly. And also, the media propping this guy up to be the savior of Major League Baseball. Yasiel Puig never had more than 75 RBI. He never had 75 RBI plus in a season. He only had 74 as his highest. How are you going to have someone down there in the 3-4-5 hole, typically, that only has that many RBI? It's almost impossible, especially the Dodgers, and especially how many people are on base with the Dodgers, and especially with the protection you're constantly going to get with anyone that plays for the goddamn Dodgers. So the statistics didn't make sense with the accusations, and his strikeouts went up every single year, all the way to him going to Cincinnati, getting in another fight, ending his career ingloriously in Cleveland, and then inevitably, I think, what, raping some chick? I mean, this dude's like in jail now. But it was not a surprise to me that this was happening at the extent that it did, chronologically and fundamentally. And this isn't a podcast on, I know it, dog, when I see it, yo, no. What it is just an example of knowing something when you see it and then finding the know-how, the data, and just the insight to make the point, which I've done on every person I just mentioned, and I forgot one, Carson Wentz. I saw Carson Wentz, and I know you've heard this, but we have a lot of new listeners, so if you haven't, South Dakota State's playing North Dakota State years ago. It was a wedding or a funeral. I think it was a wedding. Yeah, it was a wedding. And I'm at my parents' house, and I see Wentz throw like a 70-yard bomb that hits someone in the chin strap. And I'm like, anyone just see that? What the hell's this? this dude doing at North Dakota State? And we find out later, oh, he's really good. Oh, he wanted to stay close to home. Oh, USC wanted him. Oh, okay. And then he's the second pick in the draft over Jared Goff. He's better than Jared Goff. And I think Carson Wentz, if he gets his head together, still has the ability. I mean, he was an MVP candidate for Philly. He was going to win the MVP before he tore his knee up trying to get in the end zone there. He still is going to be good. I can't wait to see him return to Philadelphia. Oh, I'm sure they'll just welcome him with open arms in that hole of a city. Murder rate and district attorney aside, I'm not the biggest Eagles fan, if you didn't know, but that's okay. Class acts like Tommy Bench kind of church up the average there of the, or not just the average, but the aggregate of the Eagles fans, as far as I'm concerned. He helps that average a little bit. But Carson Wentz, one of those guys. Now, this doesn't just extend to sports. This does extend to politics. So when George Bush beat John Kerry decisively in 2004, I remember before that happened, a young man who was a state senator in Illinois had now won a U.S. senator seat over Alan Keyes, another African-American Republican, and this person, Barack Obama. Now, I've never really heard the name Barack Obama. I listened to his speech, looked to the guy next to me, who unfortunately no longer walks this earth, and I said, he's going to run for president one day. And I got some chuckles, but I just was, no, he's going to, I didn't say he'd win it. He's going to run for president. Because I had never heard an orator, a political orator, with that much authority in a room. And I'm going to say it again. Say what you want about Obama. I know a lot about him. Not a fan at all. All right. He was polarizing, racially polarizing. There's no way to get around that. And if you want to go offline, and we'll talk about how to do that in a second, if you wanted to have a discussion with me, I am more than welcome to anyone. It's a perfect stranger. We'll have it on this podcast. We'll get to that in 1 second. And I will just hammer you with facts, not my opinion. We'll save that if you want it. I'll give you the subjectivity, but I'll keep it to just objective. Starting from the very beginning of his presidency with his friend that broke into his own house that was arrested by a white cop, not because he was black, because if you're going into a window in a house, it looks suspicious. And then Obama then went to the whole, we have a racial problem. He never missed a beat when it came to dividing us with race. From Ferguson, Missouri to Trayvon Martin, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. What the fuck does that even mean, Barry? I mean, so that aside, he was a phenomenal orator, the best we've ever seen by far. And you could clearly tell he's a good-looking guy. You know, he's in shape. He knows how to handle a room. He's polished. He's very smart. He has the academic prowess to back that. And, I mean, Harvard Law Review, regardless of what you say about that, doesn't matter how he got there, he was there. And the guy just commanded a certain presence in a room that I still have yet to see with a politician to that extent as far as professionalism, polished nature, and just natural-born public speaker. You can say what you want about the teleprompter going out and all this crap. It doesn't matter. The guy was really good. So I took a notice to him early, and I saw that he wrote a book called Dreams of My Father, which came out in 1995. So when I looked at the initial Senate winning speech or acceptance speech by him, and then I Googled him and saw that he had a book, I went ahead and ordered it. And then read it in 2005 is when I read that book. And it was a horror novel. It was scarier than anything Stephen King could have written. But he basically put out the blueprint for his agenda as far as racial politics and how he goes. And again, this is everything that he wrote. All right. I'm just saying it's right there. And then in 2006, wrote The Audacity of Hope. So he did write two books about himself before he really did anything in life. But that's fine. Most of the books bought after the fact, because he became a massive public figure and still is a huge public figure, not just within the Democrat Party, but as a scope in the world. He's one of the top five most known people in the world. Top three. Might be number one. I'm serious. Who does not know who Barack Obama is? I think if you went to really obscure countries, they might not even know who Trump is. And I mean like somewhere crazy on an island in the third world, whatever. I think everyone knows Barack Obama, all right? And Oprah's endorsement with him, 2007 is when I read that book, and he was blowing up. And this is during the heat of the campaign trail to win the Democratic nomination against Hillary Clinton, in which Barack Obama's campaign was the best campaign I've ever seen in my life, next to Trump's in 2016, who defeated the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. But Obama's, in a normal strategic political layout, would be the blueprint for success. Trump's was way atypical. So we're going to put that off as a variance. This would be the standard. If I was teaching a class in political execution, we would be not that execution, executing the company strategy and how we need to go about our business. We would have Barack Obama 101. We'd bring in David Axelrod to be a speaker, and we talk about how we ran this campaign from soup to nuts. And you learn a lot because it was ran perfectly. Perfect 10 out of 10. And in doing so, reading about President Obama, and, you know, I knew it when I first saw it, that he was going to run for president. But the more I got into, the more I got into President Obama, the more it became apparent that the agenda was way more than just racial politics. It was actually some radical foundations of his, which you can look at. We've talked about this, but Rules for Radicals, written by Saul Alinsky, the father of community organizing. When I first heard community organizing, I said, what the hell is this? But like most things, the name is not indicative towards the end, the conclusion, the justification of the entire concept. Community organizing is nothing but rebel rousing and making that grow throughout communities, predicated basically on race, which is the greatest divider amongst us and was back then, still is today, still will be 40 years from now. But one time when reading that book, Obama, in The Audacity of Hope, quotes Saul Alinsky right there in chapter 7, and this is what he wrote, so I'm not just over here just making stuff up, just so you know. If you want to know who Barack Obama is, I knew it when I saw it in 2006, but when I read this, I knew it when I read it in this case. This is Alinsky in Rules for Radicals, quoted by Barack Obama, not Rules for Radicals, in The Audacity of Hope, from the book Rules for Radicals, written by Saul Alinsky. True revolutionaries do not flaunt their radicalism. They cut their hair, put on suits, and infiltrate the system from within. Let me read that one more time. True revolutionaries do not flaunt their radicalism. They cut their hair, put on suits, and infiltrate the system from within. If you don't think that that is what Barack Obama did, you are living on Jupiter. That is exactly what he did. And he laid out the playbook a long time ago and executed it accordingly and to utmost perfection if you want to grade it on the plan that was. I've given you sports examples, political example. Now I'll give you the real example. Let's take this back to 1964 in one of the most studied. My dad was in law school for a while. He could have dominated at that. He could have dominated at anything. He's got more graduate degrees than a thermometer. Apple fell far from the tree. Well, you got street smart, so kid, a.k.a. you're retarded. That's all right. So in this one, Jacob Ellis versus the state of Ohio is one of the more reviewed, revered, and always quoted cases even today in any law school that you'll go in. To give you the skinny on this, Jacobus was a pornography director, and this is where and still when this wasn't really acceptable to put. We had to define, the whole thing was around define obscenity, right? Like define what obscenity is. That's kind of like Bill Clinton. That depends on what your definition of is. I love that. But in this case, it's very difficult. And there's a lot of gray area to define what exactly, you know, this is. So this is where the rubber hits the road. And Justice Potter Stewart, was quoted as saying this: I shall not attempt today to further define the kind of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description. And perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it. That quote is down in the record books still today in every law school across this country, probably internationally. It was such a heavy case because pornography was making its way into society and people were still fighting against it. Whether that side of the fence you're on there, it doesn't matter to me. But Potter Stewart, a pretty regarded person in the Supreme Court from 1958 to 1981, that happening early in his tenure in 1964. But he basically puts it in terms that everyone can interpret. I know it when I see it. So I can't tell you what obscenity is, But when this guy's erect penis is on this chick's knees and it's in her mouth, I find that to be obscene, as an example. Yeah, and he's right, it is. Whether or not porn should be, you know, accessible or not, I mean, I'm going to go ahead and say it should be, just from a, it doesn't matter if I agree with it or not. You know, it's your prerogative. But, you know, this was a hot topic then, but that quote would still be a hot topic today. And whether it's Yasiel Puig, right, whether it's Russell Wilson, Bailey Zappi, Cameron Ward, Carson Wentz, Barack Obama, I know it when I see it. I'm the same exact way. And I know it when I see it with Eric Morris. Who's that? The guy that I've been talking about, the offensive coordinator for Washington State. That is now the, was the coach for Incarnate Word, now with Wazoo calling the plays. Guy's only 36 years old. And to understand Eric Morris, I knew about him a long time ago when he was calling the plays with Cliff Kingsbury at Texas Tech. There's so much incestual stuff here because now, you know, Zach Kittley from Western Kentucky's at Texas Tech. These guys are the same age. They probably know each other. Kittley's 6 years younger, but I guarantee they took the same exact road. In order to understand it, I knew this a while ago when I saw him racking up these ridiculous... Cliff Kingsbury was not calling the plays for Texas Tech. It was Eric Morris at barely 29, 30 years old. Kingsbury bought into this a long time ago. And he was able to have a wild amount of success at an early age. Started off there. He had a stint with Wazoo, actually, a pretty good one. Just continues to rise through the ranks. Left the OC for Texas Tech after being the inside receivers coach over there to begin the whole thing at Washington State. And basically has turned this into, oh, I'm going to Incarnate Word because this is me going to be taking over the play calling finally at a university, albeit, excuse me, in the FCS. And then taking that, you know, now to a larger spot where he'll be calling the plays at Washington State. I don't think Washington State is higher than Texas Tech on the chessboard of college football, but in this position, he's going to have a lot more free reign. And clearly they want him in there because with him came Cameron Ward, who we'll be talking about an awful lot. But his impact was immediate. Coach of the Year in 2018 as a player for Texas Tech, a receiver. He was really good. An academic All-American twice as an engineer. He's really smart. So clearly he's a good coach. Clearly he's really smart. This typically translates well on a football field. You don't have to put the pads on to know that. But he's a formations genius. And this is where I know it when I see it. I have seen him for Texas Tech, particularly as of recent with Incarnate Word, have these play calls where there's so much gamble, there's so much balls, poise, but execution in them. I'm just so comfortable already endorsing Washington State under this man's coaching tutelage with Cam Ward slinging the rock. There was one particular example that I never will forget. They're playing Sam Houston State, and that's a powerhouse in the FCS. That's like the North Dakota State of the South. And what this guy likes to do is he loves to run trips. He loves to run misdirection from these trips. He'll run trickery from the misdirection in the trips, and he'll gamble with trips in misdirection with trickery. Gamble being he hates to punt. He hates it. And I don't like to punt either. I think punting is stupid. I mean, yeah, when it's 4th and 11 from your own 20, you got to punt. But when it's 4th and 4 from your own 40, I mean, you're willing to think about this. Your defense isn't good. Who cares? Can we think we can get the first down? Try to get it. Statistically, you're seeing more and more 4th down attempts in the NFL than you ever have, and you're seeing more in college. It's just, this is where you need to go. Any analyst running any analytics on this will say, yeah, punting is pretty weak. You know, you can punt and pin them in at times, and yes, you're punting to defend field position when you're backed up, but typically, if you think you can get these first downs, you're going to want to start rolling the dice, and he loves to do it. So I knew that immediately when I saw him, and then he's just like to go for it to do it. They have very specific plays. So 4th and 9 versus Sam Houston State in a game that's slipping away 2 years ago. As clearly they know Cam Ward is as good as I think he is. They have a spy on him, and they're protecting everything inside. Basically, they're going to have you beat him over the top with a NFL safety, and at the time, a pretty highly prospected cornerback on the primary receiver for Incarnate Word then, who now plays for Washington State as a senior. But in this case, on the 36-yard line, their own 36-yard line, it's a 4th and 9. The game is slipping away. And you can kind of see that this, if they punt the ball, this game's gonna, this is gonna get away from them. So on 4th and 9 from their own 36, they run what looks like a design quarterback option to the left side of the field, the strong side. But then Cam plants his feet and throws across the other side of the field to a receiver who doesn't really have many blockers in front of him. The play looks like it's a bust. The play looks like it ain't going to work. And it looks like somebody's been hitting Grandpa's cough syrup for making this call. But not so fast. The convoy was where Cam Ward was. And the guards slipped back to protect the cutback. And then that receiver cuts back around the field, underneath, and walks behind Cam Ward and the rest of the offense. Lead blocking is Cam Ward. And this receiver rumbles forward for 15, 20 yards. And then the next play is play action, and they get it in the end zone. That sequence right there, which no one in the world will talk about except for your host, Danny Belts, clearly in the zone these days. But in this, I saw the imagination. All right, I saw the gamble. I saw it all. Everything you'd want in this guy, the misdirection, the trips. There was a bunch of receivers on one side. The whole thing was a sham. And they bit. Now, it's hard to describe that play in your head, but they all thought this was just going to be a receiver, you know, receiver pass, lateral to the receiver, and he was going to try to make a play, but, you know, it wasn't going to happen there. But it happened on the side of the field that Cam threw it from when the field was reversed. And that is an example, just a micro example of what I'm talking about. I knew that was it for me. I know it when I see it, and I know it here. I rarely miss on these futures. You know that. We clipped at almost 60% ATS last year. You know that. Futures are around 70%. If you didn't know that, now you know that. Now, the futures for Washington State, we're still going to be considering. But I know it when I see it. This guy's going to be coaching somewhere in the P5 in the next 3 years, period. Full stop. And there will be success under his coaching prowess. I have no doubts about this at all. If I could bet that, I'd put the house on it. All $628.42 of my 401k, whichever's left, I think my 401k, I think I owe money now. I think it's all gone with how the market's going. But at the same time, we have covered baseball, football, positions in football, positions in baseball, politics, now coaching. I know it when I see it. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart did in 1964. He knew it in the courtroom. And I know this one on the football field. Believe you me. And we'll get into Washington State more as we go on. Anybody seen Tommy Bench?
When someone makes a move of which we don't approve, who is it that always intervenes? UN and OAS, they have their place, I guess. But first, send the Marines.
Tommy Bench joins the Sports Analyst. What's going on, pal?
Not much, Chief. Been a few weeks. Been a few busy weeks here, but happy to be back on. We got a lot to cover, and we're going to try to hit a lot in a short period of time.
Sounds good. You may hear a little echo. Belts had to take this party into the hotel bathroom because the air condition is absurd, and it will not shut off. So nothing will stop this train, so we're doing this from a bathroom. Anyway, just letting
as long as you didn't have to take it back into the closet.
No, never record in the closet. No, I'm sent out the closet. You didn't know that? Anyway. So much to talk about. The world is your oyster. Where do we begin?
So we begin with the Texas special election for the 34th congressional district in Texas. Now, if any of our listeners are very astute and pay attention to politics, much ink has been spilled on this election. And you get everything from, oh, this shows the red wave is coming, to, oh, don't read too much into this. But here's essentially what happened. There was a special election to fill out the remainder of a seat in Texas, the 34th district, that was vacated because the congressman decided, who had said he was not going to run for re-election, decided to go work for some K Street lobbying firm, of course, because they don't go back into the real world and get real jobs. Lawmakers from both parties rarely go back into the real world and get real jobs. So there was a special election to fill out the remainder of the term from now until January of 2023. a Republican named Maya Flores was nominated, and then there was a Democrat who ran, who is actually, who was going to be the incumbent, but then because of redistricting, was able to run against Flores for this seat. Or I'm sorry, had previously served, but because of redistricting was not in Congress currently and decided to run for this seat. And the Republican won. Now, you might think, well, what's the big deal? Well, this is a largely Hispanic district. A Democrat has never represented this area in Congress since it was formed in the late 1870s, this particular district. So it's a big deal. Also, it's a Hispanic woman who was actually born in Mexico, but then came here legally and got her citizenship and is now going to represent that seat from now until January at a minimum. The other thing of note, this is a district that Biden won by plus four. That's the current Texas 34th district. Now, if she seeks to run for re-election, she'll have to run in a redistricted district that will be more favorable to Democrats. Apparently, it's a plus 11 Democrat district. But here's what's interesting. She won in a plus four Biden district. In other words, the district went for Biden by 4 points. She won by 7 points. That's an 11-point swing. Now, special elections are notorious for having low turnout. But we've already seen a lot of ink get spilled talking about voter enthusiasm, which is clearly on the edge for Republicans. Even if, again, in the next week or so, we'll expect that Dobbs decision to come out from the Supreme Court. And even if that overturns Roe versus Wade, I don't think you're going to be able to keep the fire going from now until November. And especially if the Democrats, if some of their lunatic fringe do something ridiculous like an assassination attempt on a Supreme Court justice. Oh, wait, a guy almost did that. But you didn't hear about that on the mainstream news. So I am in the camp that says this is not the only sign that there's going to be a huge red wave. In other words, if we were just pointing to this and nothing else was in our favor, I'd say you're stretching. But it's just another check mark on that side of the there's going to be a red wave. So now the only discussion is let's talk about how big a red wave. All right, let's get a little specific and start putting money where our mouth is. So you want to compare this to the same setting that Donald Trump had in June of 2018. And we use June 15th, today's date that we're recording, as the benchmark. Let me throw a few numbers out to you. June 15th, 2022, that's today. Joe Biden's approval on Real Clear Politics, which I like because it aggregates all of the latest polls, is at 39.6%. Donald Trump's approval, June 15th, 2018, was at 43.3. So his aggregate approval was almost four points better than what Joe Biden's is at this time in his presidency. And if you think about that, because remember how many stories we saw about how Donald Trump was the most unpopular president of modern history, except for, especially in his first term, you know, with the exception of George Bush, who was extremely unpopular in the later stages of his second term, and he paid the price in 2006. That's when Nancy Pelosi became the Speaker of the House largely as a result of George Bush's unpopularity. So you have this scenario where Biden is 4 points lower than where Trump was. Currently, the Republicans sit at plus 3.4 in the generic ballot. So what the generic ballot is they just ask people, hey, a you know, generic Republican versus a generic Democrat, who would you vote for? And right now it's at Republicans plus 3.4. Okay, so that's very interesting right now. So where was it at on June 15th, 2018? At that time, it was at Democrats plus 7.3. Okay, so that's sort of, you know, Trump wasn't as unpopular as Biden, but the generic ballot was more in favor of the opposite party. Now, there's some generally accepted wisdom that in these generic ballots, because if you sample the country, in a even manner, and that means you would pick up more people in big cities on the coasts. So these generic ballot polls tend to weigh a little more favorably to the Democrats. But nonetheless, it was Democrat plus 7.3, at this particular time 4 years ago.
Right.
So it ended up being the Democrats did plus 8.4. So in other words, it seemed like as things went on, the opposite party gained traction. And you've got to ask yourself this. If Republicans are at plus 3.4 right now, and by the way, the last time the Republicans had a big rout in 2010, they were at plus 1.3 at this point. So they're doing better than they were in 2010. You've got a Democrat president who's less popular than the last Republican who got cleaned up pretty good in his first midterm. Let alone in 2010, Barack Obama was still a fairly popular president. He was doing better than Joe Biden. He had net positive approval ratings throughout almost all of his presidency, if not all of his presidency. And you've got Joe Biden, whose approval ratings, you know, conservatives have been saying for a long time, oh, they're sinking. They actually stabilized in the low 40s for about 2 or 3 months. But in the last 3 to 5 weeks, they've taken another, they're dropping off a cliff again. And I would not be surprised if his approval rating on the Real Clear Politics average is below 36 by November. So you heard it here. I'm making a call on by election day. His Real Clear Politics average approval rating is going to be under 36.
I don't know how you can string together, and I'm as objective as I possibly can be. I just don't know. I don't think. If you're in a tunnel there, you really see any light, not even like an orifice of light. I don't understand. It's just complete darkness.
Right. And especially when you think about it. So, you know, there are these things, black swan events, right? 9/11 was a black swan event, or you could say it was a gray swan event because it should have been foreseeable. But the point is events that nobody's thinking of that happen, right? On September 8th, if you'd have walked up to 100 people on the street and said, what's the likelihood terrorists are going to attack this country and kill 3,000 people? You might have one or two people like, yeah, that could happen. Most people wouldn't have even paid attention to the rest of the question. So almost never, and the reason they call them black swan is because they're typically bad, unforeseen events. Like, what's the possibility of something really phenomenal and fantastic, a game-changing, phenomenal and fantastic event occurring between now and November? I mean, it almost just doesn't happen. Like, I struggle to think of, you know, you could say, well, landing on the moon. Well, yeah, but that was a work in progress. We knew that was occurring. That wasn't a surprise. Yeah, I guess it was a surprise when it happened. And okay, that was good. But, you know, we're not going to get some surprise, you know, 10% GDP growth, right? We're not going to get some ridiculously great number. We're not all of a sudden inflation. There's even if the Fed has the effect it'll have, and we'll touch on that in a second. There's no way inflation is going to come down to 2%, and inflation is not going to fall off a cliff. Or if it does, it'll be because we're in the middle of a recession and people are getting laid off. So I struggle to think what catastrophically good news, in other words, catastrophic to the Republicans, but good for Joe Biden, could potentially happen in the next 5 months.
It's kind of narrow. I mean, the thing that to look at now more than anything, and the thing that I've never seen in my life is open, you know, big media outlets such as CNN. We'll just use them as an example. I mean, they had a guy on Anderson Cooper yesterday who is a liberal. He's a, you know, not quite, I wouldn't call him a pundit. I forgot his name. He's one of their economy experts who for 15 minutes just railed. I mean, you're not even seeing the media, the ones you can depend on to take their back and spin it whatever way. They're just not even trying that anymore. I mean, Don Lemon is asking certain questions. Anderson Cooper. I mean, these are guys that will take their back regardless. It's their job. And now I almost think they're thinking the only smart thing to do is to just railroad him. Have you noticed this?
Right. No. There's definitely, and because you're hearing the whispers more, Politico, Axios, those kind of outfits are saying there's whispers among the Democrat power players that Joe Biden shouldn't be on the ballot in 2024. AOC wouldn't flat out. She said, well, you know, we'll have to see what happens. So there's definitely apprehension. And it's because it's funny. Joe Biden was probably their best bet to beat Donald Trump in 2020, right? Yeah. The milquetoast, boring old guy returned to normalcy. At least that was his pitch. Now he's not governing like that, but that was the pitch. I'm not evil. I'm not bombastic. I'll just kind of be a quiet old guy who piddles around and just eats vanilla yogurt all day, or vanilla pudding all day. the trouble is he's shown to be so ineffective and the inmates are running the asylum that he's now probably the least likely person that Donald Trump could beat in a 2024 rematch. Now, I can tell you, as somebody who's gotten more and more involved in Republican Party politics in the county I live in, there's a growing subset of the Republican Party that's saying, I think we should get a fresh face, and I really like Ron DeSantis. I think you're going to see his stock continue to rise, especially if he keeps utilizing political power to implement conservative governance. If he keeps doing that, I think he's just going to see his stock continue to rise. And the more Trump continues to appear like he's looking back on 2020 and not looking forward, you're going to see a divergence. Now, if Trump flips the script and starts talking nonstop about what he'll do to get the country out of the doldrums and the malaise that it's in, I think he could regain that mantle of being the presumed front runner and presumptive nominee should he decide to run. But if he seems like he's still picking the 2020 fight and he can't get over that, he's going to leave the opening for Ron DeSantis. But we've gotten way off course. Look, we wanted to focus on the midterm. So here's a couple of numbers to throw at you. The current House makeup is 222 Democrat to 212 Republicans. So they have about a 10-seat advantage. There's a handful of seats that are vacant in case somebody did the math and said, that doesn't add up to 435. There's a handful of seats that are vacant currently. The largest Republican majority was back in the, I don't know, the 111th Congress back in 81st or something like that, way back in 1921 to 1923, the 67th Congress. I knew I had that pulled up. And that was 302 Republicans to 131 Democrats. Okay. Do I think Republicans are going to win 70-some seats in November? In net 70 seats, because they'll lose a few, but will they net 70 seats? I don't think so.
No.
But the largest, most recent majority was 247 after 2014. So, you know, remember there was the big wave in 2010 where Republicans netted 63 seats, flipped the House. They held on to the House from 2010 all the way through to 2018. In 2014, they even added on because that, you know, Obama was on the ticket in 2012, actually helped Democrats. And then in 2014, he was not on the ticket. And so Republicans made gains, had 247. So the ask is, can Republicans net 35 seats? I'm going to throw a stake in the ground. I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
And I'm going to make a statement. The Republicans will have more than 250 seats in the House of Representatives after the 2022 election. There's my stake in the ground. North of 250. Don't think they'll hit 255, but they will be north of 250 seats in the House of Representatives. There's just too many things going against the Democrats. Quick comment about what Republicans do to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. I almost don't think they could screw it up bad enough to not win a majority. The question is on the Senate side, and we'll spend some time going into that in the next couple of weeks. Just know that there are things the Republicans can do to screw things up on the Senate side.
Well, the Republicans can screw up a two-car funeral. I mean,
right. Yeah. Right. So we'll dive into the Senate next week, but I did want to leave time to talk about something monumental and epic that has recently happened.
Yeah, no, we definitely will look forward to that. I think, and not to derail this, but I think in terms of like sports, some teams just don't know what to do with a lead. You know, bad teams get a lead and then you can see it. They just don't know what to do with it. They aren't used to playing from behind. And in doing that, it kind of is their makeup. And I think that right now, you know, even because we talked about the media, I don't think they know what to do right now. And not necessarily with a lead, but with the presidency, it would almost benefit them to have a Republican like Trump back in to give them something to do again. It's almost like they want to lose this game on purpose.
Oh, for sure.
Not have a lead, because then CNN would be able to do what they do best. I mean, Donald Trump still gets as much press as the sitting president on these networks. Right. Unbelievable. And, you know, for a guy that lost after his first term, it's almost like I think that they, for a rating standpoint, almost need it. They need to lose the, quote, lead. They need to get behind again so they can get where they're comfortable. You know what I'm saying? It's right.
No, I agree. And you know, it's really interesting. If Donald Trump were still president, I guarantee the Democrats would add to their majority in the House of Representatives right now.
I would tend to agree with that. Yes.
So, but he's not. And Joe Biden's just done a horrible job. And again, if Donald Trump were president, look, some of these things, you know, inflation would be, there'd be inflation, but you know, we'd be drilling for oil and gas. Keystone XL wouldn't have gotten canceled at all. I really do think gas, it would be more expensive. It wouldn't be as outrageous as it is. So there's some things he could have affected and some things that would have gotten the better of him. But again, you don't get the sense that the Joe Biden administration with Democrats in control of the House and the Senate are capable of doing anything between now and November to even give the appearance that they're going to change things or make things better. But again, I want to close this out. We got to talk about a movie that recently hit movie theaters.
Yes.
I'm not sure if we have enough time, but I think we have to.
5 minutes we have for this. Yes, I think we're talking about Jurassic Park, psych.
No.
The movie was awful.
It was disappointing.
Top Gun, Maverick, which, and I'll go first on this one. I saw it in Dothan, Alabama 2 days ago, and I walked in there waiting to, you know, with the reviews and everything aside, try to be objective on my call on this one. And it was still one of the best movies I've ever seen. I give it a 9.5 out of 10, 10 being, you know, just the perfect movie. I don't really know where you could get in here and say it was bad. And I'm sure you have a comment on this. They didn't even throw any PC of anything in your face. It was not politicized at all.
No.
Which is just incredible, because that's kind of what movies should do, is stick to the, you know, it's a movie. And I applaud them for that, because Jurassic Park had more undertones than Avatar.
Right. Okay? Big corporation evil. Right. So I thoroughly enjoyed it beginning to end. I mean, just even the simplicity of the opening. Yes, it was the same music. Yes, it was the same scenes instead of just F-18. There were F-18s and there was an F-35 Joint Strike Fighter in the opening, taken off of aircraft carriers, just like the original. And they were taking off of the Abraham Lincoln. I don't know if you caught the Lincoln bobblehead doll.
Yeah.
That's kind of one of the last, that's the USS Abraham Lincoln, one of the prized carriers of the US Navy's fleet. And they even kept the font the same, which I thought was perfect. And they, you know, they put the mission statement. They did add men and women, which is accurate. And that's an example of, that reflects that times are different. The military is different today than it was in 1986. One of my very good friends, a classmate of mine from the Naval Academy, she is a Top Gun graduate. So women do go to Top Gun, and that should be reflected. And it was, but it was accurately reflected in that there was one woman in a class of, you know, 12 or 13 dudes. That's about what the ratio is, especially in the Naval aviation community. And again, just like you said, they didn't make it PC. I mean, you know, and here's one thing to keep in mind. This movie was largely filmed in 2018 and 2019.
Yeah.
Because remember, they were going to release it in 2020. So it was filmed before all the wokeness went into hyperdrive. Thank God. Because I can only imagine what they would have done if it were filmed like during 2021 after the George Floyd peaceful protests. But they did. And look, the group of pilots at Top Gun was more diverse, but nobody got up on a soapbox and lectured everybody about it. And the woman didn't stand up and talk about how she was a lesbian or some, you know, and I also did on the romantic score appreciate they didn't like force the, okay, her and Rooster get together. No, the only romance story, the only romantic angle was Tom Cruise and Penny Benjamin, who's mentioned in Top Gun 1, played by Jennifer Connelly. And I thought that was great how they weave that together. And they struck the perfect balance of reminding you of the original, harkening back to the original, but bringing it up to date, and having Tom Cruise portray a guy in his early to mid 50s who's coming to the end of his career, and not try to make him seem like he's 32 and still got 20 years. Nope, he's coming to the end. He's got it, you know, like the what is it, Toby Keith song? I'm not as good as I once was, but I'm as good once as I ever was. Right? He's right in that wheelhouse, and they just. They put it, and even there were some subtle things, like when the young guys tossed him over the edge for not being able to pay the bill, and he comes walking in the next day. That's just like when Kelly McGillis came walking in after, you know, they embarrassed themselves singing to her in the bar the night before, right? Like we see the similarities, but it worked. It just played well. I was excited when I went in, thrilled when I left. Some of the highlight parts. when him and Miles Teller, you know, they crash land. Oh, by the way, spoiler alert. I'm going to get into details. So if you haven't seen it, turn off the pod, come back.
We can't go too far into the Top Gun, but go ahead.
But that's that moment when him and Miles Teller, it's like, oh, what are we going to do? And I thought, man, there's not like enough time left in the movie for them to, you know, escape an evasion. And how, like, I really didn't know, how are they going to get out of here? And then the moment you see that back tail fins of the F-14 on the enemy airstrip, and you know, I know where this is going, and I love it, and I'm totally here for it.
Yeah, Grand Theft Airplane.
It was, which, by the way, you know, was a little bit of a ripoff from The Great Escape. We all remember James Garner took the blind guy in a Nazi plane off of a Nazi runway and almost made it. So,
great movie.
And then one last comment. The only unrealistic thing about the movie, because I did, again, my friend, I made a comment on Facebook saying this was great, don't ruin it. And she said, you know what, Tom, it was all realistic. Just believe it was all realistic. So I appreciated that. But the most unrealistic thing is a woman who looks like Jennifer Connelly, who owns a bar, a sailboat, and a Porsche, is still single.
Yes.
Because we all know there'd be a line a mile long of guys in their late 40s and early 50s wanting to make her the next, you know, Mrs. X second wife, all of whom would be very eligible bachelors. So.
And the thing, yeah, exactly. And the thing I'll add real quick is you had two movies made kind of a remake with the original cast come out at the same time, Jurassic Park and Top.
Right.
Spoiler alert for those who hadn't seen Jurassic Park.
Jurassic World.
Because Jurassic Park's one of my favorite movies ever, the first one. But when Dr. Ian Malcolm takes the flaming locust on a stick and throws it into the, and they try to reenact the whole Ian Freeze when he was doing this to the Tyrannosaurus. Now he has a flaming 2-foot locust on a skewer and he throws it into the amphibious carnivore's mouth, who then becomes a dragon that starts
fire.
It couldn't have been any more stupid. So on one side you have a movie that did this more than the right way, and then another
beautifully, yeah,
the other was just a total money suck to get the, it was Jurassic Park was terrible, but
right, yeah,
Jurassic World, whatever, I don't know, but it was horrible. But anyway,
right, and they totally, because again, you could tell they were trying to harken back to the original. And they just missed the mark time after time after time after time, but Top Gun didn't.
No.
It just, and even scenes like, you know, he rode the original motorcycle, but then he rode a new one when he actually transferred bases.
Yeah.
And I thought all the other supporting cast, like John Hamm, perfectly cast as kind of a tightly wound senior admiral, although they should have given him a little bit of gray hair. He's not quite old. He's almost old enough to be a 3-star admiral. The black guy, Warlock, I don't know the actor's name. He was perfectly cast. Like, there were so many people in there I just saw and thought, that's perfect typecasting for an admiral or a vice admiral or a rear admiral upper half, which is a 2-star admiral. So many people were well cast. And all the pilots I know, they all wish they were as good looking and handsome as all the, and jacked as all the guys in the movie. But, you know, they're, and I will say this, the pilots I know are a little more, they're not quite as, you can't be that reckless in reality. They are pretty by the book, and you do it, you have to be really smart and disciplined, and it's really more about being able to solve problems and think quickly on your feet as opposed to having this killer instinct. But I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but it was just, I thought, well cast all around. I've already seen it twice. I might go see it again for a third or fourth time, just to fully enjoy it on the big screen. That is the other thing. If you're debating like, well, I'll just wait. No, do not wait until this comes out on DVD or streaming. See it on the big screen. Yeah, you have to.
Not much money, $10, $12, but yeah, totally worth it. Anyway, but just, I still can't stop. And then my buddy pirated. I told him to film the scene for me in Jurassic Park where the fire breathing amphibious carnivore starts breathing fire from a flaming locust. And I watched it so much, my wife had to tell me to go into the guest room because I couldn't stop laughing all night. It was that ridiculous. You're not supposed to laugh at that, but I laughed harder at that scene. There's only one scene I've laughed harder at, and it was with you when we got a bunch of booze a long time ago and went in to go watch Bad Santa. when right. he looked at that kid in the food court and says, I'm on my fucking lunch break. And I just lost it. I laughed harder at Jurassic World than I did that scene. And it's not a comedy. So anyway, whatever. But no stars out of 10 in one and 10 out of 10 basically in the other. So anyway, yeah, we'll look forward to having you on next week. Keep us in the loop on the numbers regarding the Senate and the House as we get closer to this November bloodbath we are going to see. So
looking forward to it.
All right, man. We'll catch you next week, Chief.
All right, out here.
I had to let the music ride a little longer in respect of Top Gun. 55,000 gun salute to that movie for not woking it up, as Tommy Bench eloquently put, not bowing to the times. Top Gun, the best movie I've seen since Top Gun. Top five movie of my life. Can't wait to watch it again in the theater. Thanks for joining episode number 104, but I know it when I see it. And thanks to Tommy Bench for jumping on the Sports Antidote. We'll have him come on for more political commentary as we get closer to the midterms, as I know you are interested in his analysis. Quantitative analysis and objective opinion on things. Sometimes subjective, but who cares, right? He'll be president soon enough of this country. Bro Exotic will be back next week. Be sure and rate, subscribe, and review. Reach out and touch a brother and tell somebody about the Sports Antidote today. Keep it real, Antidotians!